Welcome to Exploration 1, Module 10. Alright guys, I'm going to go on to AutoVox, and we're going to do the boring subnetting stuff first, just to get that out of the way, because a few people had questions. And then we'll go on to the more fun configurary, routery bits and pieces. Now, otherwise, also fair warning, I think ANSI is trying to promote IPv6, because we really should run IPv6, you know, and we all should have IPv6, and we don't. So Ian is going to do a lecture on the structure and architecture of IPv6. And then I will be doing a lecture on how you actually get it to go. So we'll announce all of those, but just letting you guys know, because you might actually want to turn up to that and have a listen. I'll be talking about tunnel brokers and Teredo tunneling and all that sort of fun stuff. So that is, yeah, that's where we're at.
That should be really useful.
Sorry, is that this is where it's outside of class?
I might be able to run it on a Wednesday morning if Ian's around. I mean, that's suitable for exploration. We usually run them on a Thursday evening, your time, Friday morning chat.
All right, fair enough.
I mean, if you haven't been up into the Cavicast area, it's certainly worth a look, and soon it'll be linked in on our Facebook page. Don't make me tweet them all. They're actually quite a good resource, and we're going to try and get them out there and get people downloading them and stuff. And yes, Dirtcaster is one of the things I will be doing when I'm not talking to you lot. To get a podcasty feed so that you can fill your iDevice up with them.
One of those recordings is what's got me using NVDA, so well done.
I actually have it on the netbook, I must say, and I'm sorry to say this, and you can shoot me when you meet me, Jason, but I was actually sad to load JAWS. It made me die a little bit inside. I'm just like, I suppose I really should load it, but NVDA was really nice, and then everything went slower after that, so yeah. What can you do? I mean, that said, JAWS has got lots of other things it does that NVDA doesn't, but everything just slowed down a little bit after I loaded that.
Well, you don't need to apologize to me. Everything's all good.
Well, you know how it is. I don't want the Freedom Mafia knocking on my door and go, why aren't you running all of your copies of JAWS? Don't ask me why they've got German accents. Probably because they're the Mafia. Okie dokie. I'm going to go on to AutoVox. This is lecture 11, No, it's lecture 10. I'm pretty sure it's lecture 10. I'll have to go and have a look.
Are we recording, Kerry?
I'm recording. If you want to get on and record...
I've got it too, yeah.
Sorry, do I need to stop recording so that you can say something, or will you say whatever it was you were going to say after we've stopped recording if it's like that?
No, I was just curious just make sure we were recording.
Now, unfortunately, I'm going to upset Kevin a little bit this morning. Well, maybe. And I'm going to do a very, very, very quick demo of BC, which we did a chat on Friday, which Kevin did a good job on, but I want to show you guys BC specifically so that you guys can see the cool sort of things it does, and I'll channel that into chat. And not to detract from Kevin's presentation, which was quite good, which I've still got to find the time to sit down and process, but that'll happen soon. I'm going to show you all how to use BC. Now, BC is not currently on the pod workstations yet. That will be fixed. I have a new virtual machine image that I'm going to roll out onto them very soon. And BC will be on that image. So, if you have access to a Unix shell, avail yourself of that in the next 20 to 30 minutes, and we will demonstrate BC. If you have a Mac, you have BC. If you have Windows, there is a copy of BC in Extras, which Kevin has graciously provided to us from wherever he snaffed it from. And you can grab that from Extras and install it, and then you'll need to CD into the directory and run BC yourself because it doesn't make funky shortcuts. But that'll be in about 15, 20 minutes or so. So just giving everybody fair warning that those sorts of things are going to happen.
You said it already exists in the Mac terminal, Kerry?
It might not. Was it an extra, Kevin?
On the
just
Mac?
Try Bravo.
Yeah, it exists.
Okay, it is on the Mac by default?
Yes.
Ah, Ripper.
Okay, I've got one within reach, so I'll follow along that way.
Alright. So we'll demonstrate BC, and we'll show that in a minute. Okay, I'm going to go on to AutoVox, and we will start talking about various things. Okie dokie. We are looking at various subnetting exercises, and both of which are due by next week. Okay, so if you've already submitted your first one, you're well on track to getting your second one done by next week. And we're going to talk about them and we're going to solve any problems that you might have, or at least try and solve any problems that you might have. And then we're going to talk about the various bits and pieces, and then you guys can, of course, ask me questions individually if you still have problems with the subnet exercises. Bless you, Grace. There we go. You probably all heard her sneeze there, possibly.
So what you're saying is we can ask Grace for help with them if we need it?
Oh, I believe so. They can ask you for help with your subnet with their subnetting exercises, Grace?
If they want to.
If they want to, was the response to that. She can get a pegboard out and try and help. She won't turn you away, but if you would like, if you want a non-technical assistance on subnetting, Grace will be your person to try. She'll help you out with it all, if you really want to talk to her about it. But yeah, you can.
It'll take a while, but we'll get there.
Yeah, it'll take a while, but you'll get there. She's not completely allergic to subnetting. She just doesn't enjoy it too much, and it takes a little while, which is how it did for me when I first started. So it's all good. But yeah, she will help you because she does actually teach Discovery One. But she, you would get faster results by calling me. Okay. Has anybody got any questions on the specific subnet exercise? Did everybody sort subnet exercise one out? Was everybody happy with that one?
I have one very stupid question.
Okay.
Okay, this is probably how dumb this question actually is. Near the end of it, where you, you take the, you're basically figuring out whether the packet is going to be sent on the local network or off the network where you end the IP with the subnet. I understand that, and then you get the result. But how do you compare that then to the gateway? Because none of those examples in the exercise, as far as I can tell, result in it being on the network. So I just thought I'd see if I'm doing that wrong or...
Okay, this is in binary exercise. Is this in the first binary exercise?
Yeah.
I don't see any mention of gateways in here. Do we?
It says destination address, and then it has subnet address, and then it has a gateway.
Ah, okay, you're looking at the routing table. You're looking at the one where we're looking at the routing table? That's the one you're talking about? Where I talk about the AND gates, or is it further down?
Yeah.
Didn't we go through this last week? I mean, I can go through it again.
Yeah, this is the part we looked at last week, because I had the question about...
I mean, I can go through it again. Basically, what you're doing...
No.
Okay, well... Oh, okay, so his question is that the gateway address isn't on the subnet. That is a valid point. So I should probably rejig the exercise so that they are on the subnet. But basically what has happened in this particular instance is that you actually have a route that points specifically at the gateway that you're trying to reach. So I haven't actually documented the host route that actually gives you the route to that gateway. If you look at the configuration of a machine... now is everybody in chat, because I'm about to start typing stuff at you as I infuriatingly do each week. Okay, so I'm going to give you an example of where our gateway isn't actually on any of the networks that we're actually connected to. Okay, so say we have a routing table, and as we know, it's destination mask gateway and interface. Okay, so we're looking at a pretty standard computer. So we have a destination of 192.168.1.0. I'm just saying this for the recording. Mask 255.255.255.0. Gateway, none. Interface, what do they call it? Local area connection. Okay. Okay, before I continue, does everybody understand what that line I just typed into chat means? Because if it doesn't, I need to explain it.
Yeah, I think it makes sense.
Basically, the Class C subnet 192.168.1.whatever, because the subnet mask is 255.255.255.0, in other words, 24 bits for... Yeah, thanks. Just sort of, yeah, greet him happily, just quieter. Yeah, that's good. Okay. 192.168.1.blah routes to the local area connection, and because there is 24 bits in the network portion of the address, 8 bits in the host portion specify which host we're going to talk to. And as we've covered, if all of the bits in that section are set to 0, it's the network address, and if any of the bits are all set to 1, that is the broadcast address. Any questions on any of that?
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. So, we now have another router, with another route, which is this. 0.0.0.0, mask 0.0.0.0, gateway 123.123.123.123, interface, dodgy modem. Okay, now, the dodgy modem interface is one of those little plug-in USB modems. Has anybody ever seen them? You stick a SIM in one end of them, you stick an SD card in another end of them, and then you stick another end of them into your computer, and occasionally they come up and work and connect you to the internet. Everybody's familiar with those?
Yep.
Right, well, what you've actually got here is you've got a... route that says that every packet that the computer doesn't know about is going to go to 123.123.123.123, which is not on your subnet. The gateway is off your subnet. Now, if you think about this, your router, by definition, has to have gateways off the subnet that you're on, otherwise you wouldn't be able to talk outside your own subnet. What you do see under Windows is a route like this. 123.123.123.123. I'm scaring myself with the ease of which I can come up with this stuff. I need a life. Mask 255.255.255.255. Gateway n/a interface dodgy modem.
I've been wondering about that. Yeah, what is that?
That is the host route that actually points... Because Corey's right. If there is no route in the routing table that tells you how to get there, you don't know how the packets are actually going to get there. So if packets are destined to a specific IP address, there needs to be a route that resolves that to an interface, otherwise the machine won't know what interface to send it over. Now, there are two ways of doing that. Under Unix-based operating systems, you can just point a route directly at an interface. You go, for example, route add default GW, oh no, dev PPP0. That will put a default gateway in that points out through your PPP0 interface, which is, interestingly enough, the sort of interface that these modems are going to use. Now, because a point-to-point link is point-to-point, in other words, there's one thing at one end and one thing at the other, injecting packets down a PPP interface with no specific destination IP address will have them shoveled to the other end of the point-to-point interface. So I will edit that lab and stick some fake routes in so that you actually do see that there is a gateway to 123.123.123.123 and whatever. The reason I didn't put it in originally was because the point of the exercise was you doing the anding. The point of your exercise was not to worry about the fact that the machine didn't know how to get to its gateway. But, well spotted. Is that clear to everybody, perhaps?
Yeah, sorry about that.
Oh, no, that's a valid question. Yeah, it's a valid question. We take those questions. Anybody else got any other questions with binary exercise one?
Well, that root that you just put into the chat, have we seen that subnet mask before? /24? Because that's giving me pause. I don't remember seeing that. So it's all network and zero host bits, and I don't know what to think of that.
Ah, the default route is meant to match anything. So the default route is actually 0.0.0.0, mask 0.0.0.0, destined to a particular IP address, and that's how the default route is actually structured.
I get that. It's the other one you just put in, the opposite subnet mask, is the one I've never seen before.
Let me have a look.
255.255.255.255.
Oh, that is /32. That is a route to a specific host. So if you have a 192.168.1.0 subnet and then you want to get to an address, a host on 155.155.155.155, you can actually add a route in that says route add, blah, 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 blah. In fact, I will even put this in. Route add dash host 155.155.155.155 netmask 255.255.255.255 GW A.B.C.D. So what that actually says is that I can reach 155.155.155.155 and only that IP address via this other gateway. So it's a host specific route.
Okay, that makes sense. I was just, I'm pretty sure that I've never seen that subnet mask before, so I didn't know what to think of it.
Yeah, actually, I'll see if Ian knows. Ian, do you know why the default route has a mask of 0.0.0.0? Okay, no, that makes sense. I just hadn't actually seen them. Okay, the reason the default route has a mask of 0.0.0.0 is because you don't want to mask anything out at all. You want anything to travel over that route, whether it's reserved, multicast, whatever. So it's a catch-all.
No, got it. And /32 is the opposite. It's only to a specific host.
Hang on a second.
What's the matter?
Okay, sorry about that, guys. I'm back. Yeah, so the 0.0.0.0 masks off nothing, and that gives us the ability to send everything over that default route. Okay, any other questions regarding binary exercise one?
I think I got it. All done after you gave me your little hint there, Carrie, about what that 254.0 did right at the end there. I did send you a revised version, so hopefully I did it right and I didn't get like the whole thing wrong, because that would upset me. but I think I got it.
Okay. I will look at that, because I think that came through, and I will. I'll get to that in a second. I'll certainly chase that up. Just give me a sec. I'm just gonna chase something up here locally before Ian disappears, and then I'll be right back with you guys, and we will continue on. So if anybody's got any questions on exercise two, think them up in the next 5 seconds, and we'll get to that.
Yeah, that final question in binary exercise one, where it had the mask of 255.255.254.0, that one threw me off, but I think I got it. Did you guys have a chance to listen to that that subnet stuff?
Oh, not yet. It's still on my list. I keep meaning to, and then I don't know.
Oh, I get it. I understand.
The scary thing is, I think I'm starting to get it.
Yeah, it was fairly amazing. Like I had a hell of a time with it for a long time, and then I just, in you know, within about an hour, it all clicked at once. It was pretty cool. Chris, do you know of any of a good place that you can test? Because I'm running a data a website on my local server here that's running like Joomla for content management. Do you know if there's a good way to test if you're vulnerable to like SQL injection attacks and stuff like that?
That's something that Joomla should take care of for you. So I mean you should monitor their site for any like security advisors that they think about and you know make sure you're running the latest version and all that. I mean other than actually like learning about how to exploit those and trying to exploit your site. Yeah, I mean that's something that Joomla should be taking care of for you.
Okay, I wondered if there was like a test suite or something I could run on it to see if it would break.
Well, maybe. I mean, because they work by like Joomla is a big enough target that there might be something out there for it. Because you sort of have to know what your, you know, the names of the tables that you're trying to affect and that sort of thing. But Joomla is a pretty big target, so. But I don't know of anything specific that I can point you to.
Okay, yeah, no problem.
I mean, it's probably not vulnerable to them. I mean, it's sort of like there's some, you know, if you like sanitize your input and use parameterized SQL queries, you're relatively safe.
Another good resource for this sort of stuff, and I don't know whether they cover the SQL stuff, but there's a thing called Hack This Site. Can't remember whether it's .org or .com, and it teaches you how to do cross-site scripting and stuff, so that might be another resource. I have no idea what you're talking about, but that just occurred to me.
That's a good thing to look at, too, different from SQL injection, but yeah, that's another issue that Joomla should also like already protect you against, but might not hurt to read up on it.
Cool.
Okay, I'm back. Now, anything exciting happen in my absence? Looks like my sensitivity is not sensitive. There we go, let's try that. Has anybody actually seen whether that monitor thing is accessible? I've never got it to work, the thing that shows you where you're getting to. I've seen sighted people use it.
What thing?
You can go test with monitor under Ventrilo in the setup, and it'll actually show you what number you're getting to, so that you don't have to guess at your sensitivity.
Oh, I don't know.
Okay, no, that's all right. Okay, so, now we talked about, I think that's still not sensitive enough, but we talked about binary exercise 1, and somebody has talked about the subnet mask of 255.255.254.0. Now, did anybody else have any trouble with that one? That is a 512 address subnet. And it has 9 bits for host, and it has 23 bits for network.
Can you repeat those numbers of bits?
9 and 23.
For the host and the network. Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Sorry, has a thumb drive gone missing, guys? Was it on the computer that she was working on?
No, she
didn't. That's your fault, I'm afraid.
No, it's totally my fault.
Okay, so 9 and 23. Everybody happy with 9 and 23?
Yep.
Alright, now anybody else got any other, like, theoretical questions about the binary exercise 2? So basically what binary exercise 2 is getting you to do is to come up with a subnet scheme of private addressing for each site, and you're going to connect all of the sites together with OpenVPN. That's just the one I happen to use. And basically what is going to happen is you are going to have a different subnet for each organization, or a different number of subnets for each organization. I would have a supernet for each organization and then subnet each of the branches into students and teachers and stuff. And then once you've done that... Once you've done that, you can then put the routes in for your routing table and say which ISPs you're gatewaying it through.
So, I mean, have we covered that stuff yet? Like, how to actually do a routing table? Because it seemed like there was stuff in there we hadn't covered yet.
Well, we kind of did. Like, I thought we'd covered routing tables. I explained to everybody that you have a destination, which is a network address. You have a subnet mask. And you have a gateway. And basically what you have to do is you have to figure out what the network addresses of the networks you're routing to are, what is Darwin's network address, what is Perth's network address, what is Sydney's network address, what gateways are you routing through, and make sure you put the correct subnet masks in. So, pardon me, maybe I need to explain something a little more clearly, but I was pretty sure I had covered how that worked.
Okay, but then there was something in that exercise about how to route. You had to route one through somewhere else to get to somewhere else. I'm not explaining that very well, but yeah, there was something in there about that I wasn't sure.
Yeah. You had to route from Sydney to Perth rather than route and then route to Darwin. That's what you're talking about?
Right.
Okay, so that's easy. In Sydney's routing table, put the network address of put the network address of Darwin, tell it that it's routing to Perth's gateway, and then that way the traffic will travel to Perth's gateway, which then has a route that points its stuff to Darwin.
Okay. So do we have to actually put the, for the OpenVPN links, do we have to do IP addresses for the point-to-point links, so that the .252 masks?
You don't actually have to generate the entire .252 masks if you don't want to, although that is the best way to do it. But basically, one end of your link is called, you know, SID-ISP, and the other one is called Perth-ISP. So you don't actually have to do the subnetting for that. You just have to have names for those links. I did actually sort of save you the work of doing the subnet for the little ones.
Okay.
So what you've got to understand about a routing table is that a routing table only looks at destination IP addresses. So the fields you have in a routing table, which we covered in one of the earlier modules, which I realized was a long time ago, is you have a destination, which is a network address. You have a mask, which tells you how many bits are network and how many bits are host. You have a gateway. You have an interface. And you also have a metric. Now, I wasn't nasty enough to tell you that what you needed to do was to create a route from Sydney to Darwin with a higher metric than the route from Sydney to Perth, because that would be nasty, and that's not part of the exercise. But the metric tells you how much the route costs and which route you're going to prefer based on what you want. So that is essentially how that works.
So, is this a mesh where everyone is connected to each other office, or is each office only connected to the ISP?
Each office is only connected to the ISP, but I just put the link from Sydney. Sorry, the link from Perth to Darwin being cheaper in as a wrinkle, so that you would have to route the Darwin traffic via Perth from Sydney, just to make the routing tables look a bit different.
But if each office only has one connection to the ISP, and so each office only has one default gateway for traffic going out of that local network, I'm not sure of how you would do the routing to one place via another.
What you actually do is, on the router, which you've got to leave space for on the subnets, the router is actually a smart box that decides where stuff is going to go. So if the stuff is destined from Sydney to Brisbane, it goes directly over the ISP link, over the OpenVPN, and turns up in Brisbane. That's fine. But if it's going to go to Darwin from Sydney, then it gets routed to the Perth box, which has IP forwarding enabled, and the Perth box then receives the traffic over its VPN, packages it all up, and shovels it over the VPN to Darwin. So it was sort of an odd exercise with a bit of a wrinkle to say that, so it was cheaper to get traffic from Perth to Darwin than it was to get traffic from Sydney to Darwin. No, maybe they've got a different sort of link up there or something, but that was just so that all the routing tables didn't look the same.
Okay, we can chat about it later, and I'll show you what I've come up with for my for how I would set this up, because I'm thinking maybe I'm setting it up in a way other than what you expected.
Okay, no, that's fine. We can certainly go through that and look at that. Has anyone else had a look at that exercise yet, or has people found it a bit daunting? Sorry, John.
Yeah, I'm not quite understanding the routing bit. If I understand properly, each subnet, like for each, say your students and your admin, they would each have to have a gateway address on their subnet, right? So whenever traffic went off of their local subnet, and so a student A to student B, student A wanted to go to somewhere else instead, that it would go to the gateway. But I'm not quite following how that translates into the overall VPN link between the two offices, exactly what has to happen there to go from, say, a student at one office to a student at another office.
Okay, so what I was trying to show was that if you have a supernet for each office, in other words, say you have a supernet of 1,024 IP addresses or a supernet of 512 IP addresses, you break that up into subnets so that you get your students and your staff and your admin or whatever. I don't have the exercise in front of me. I could pull it up and have a look. And when you subnet the supernet, that means that outside the network, the only thing you care about is the supernet. You only care about Sydney supernet, Hobart supernet, Adelaide supernet, Perth supernet, Darwin supernet. Inside the network, it's the job of the router to route stuff properly. But outside the network, you only know that, you know, Sydney is 4.0/23. That's all the Sydney router needs to know. It doesn't need to know about the internal routing that's inside on the actual router at Perth to handle how it's broken down once it hits that subnet. So basically what you're doing is you're coming up with one big subnet for each office, a subnet that's big enough to hold everything, and then you're breaking that big subnet down into smaller subnets that will hold the students, the staff, and whatever. So that's the thrust of the exercise. And then at the end, you actually show the trace route symbolically to say traffic from a student in Sydney will go via, you know, to Darwin will go via Sydney's router to Perth via Perth's router to Darwin, and then will be handled in Darwin. So that's the way the exercise breaks down.
So the router would have a gateway address on each subnet, like students and admin or whatever the subnets were inside of one of the offices, and then once the traffic hit that, went to that gateway address, then the router would take that and send it off to whichever other office.
Yeah. Does anybody remember me virtually pounding the desk in one of the lectures and saying, for a router to communicate with any host, it must have an IP address on the subnet of that host? I remember ranting about that in lecture three or four, but that was a long time ago. So you must have a gateway for each network that is configured on the router. So in Sydney's case, Sydney's router is going to have enough interfaces to handle the students, the admin, and whatever else, and it's going to have an IP address on all of those subnets. It has to.
Any other queries on that?
No, mine's on the other one that we haven't talked about yet, which is called Subnetting 1 TXD.
Ah, let me open that one up and check to make sure I know what you're talking about.
That's the busy builders one.
Yes, that would be the busy builders one. My wife at the time was obsessed with Bob the Builder, so we had to have a builders subnet exercise. Can we fix it? Yes, we can. Okay, what was your question on this one? I've got it open here.
So on this one, I've read through and just wasn't sure if I was doing the right thing or not. And you can disregard my email question since we're going to talk about it now. So I get that you want a Class C for four offices. So I could do a 192.168, 1.0, 2.0, and so on, I'm assuming. Then you want three subnets at each office, one for builders, one for staff, one for printers, servers. So then if we just look at the first one, for example, are you asking just for, if I broke this up into four subnets of so many hosts to cover the total plus the growth that you're asking for, or do you want a subnet defined for each, or a mask defined for each of the three subnets? I'm not sure exactly what data I'm supposed to provide.
Okay, there should be three subnets, one for admin, one for builders machines. Okay, so the point here is 15 admin staff. So basically what that question is asking you, there are 15 admin staff and you need a gateway. Can you put that on a subnet of 16? No, I need a subnet that's 32 big. Okay, so you need to come up with the mask and the IP addresses for that subnet. Five builders, can we put that on a subnet of 8? Yes, we can. So we're good, we make a subnet of 8. Depending on the growth. So it's got to be big enough to take into consideration the growth and still fit in the subnet boundary.
Okay, I need to do it over. That's what I was afraid of. So we do need to do just enough headroom as possible for each subnet that's required. I was just doing one for each office and saying, okay, for example one, we could do four subnets of up to 62 hosts, and that would be room for everything. But that's not what you wanted.
Well, it's technically correct, but I did want people to get practice with the masks and stuff, and that just isn't as much horrible fun if we do it that way. That is a valid solution, though.
Nah, it's fair enough. I'll leave what I have, since you've already gone on record saying it's valid, but I'll also go back and do the rest and do each subnet for each office.
Yeah, that's sort of the plan.
I could see why you would make smaller subnets if you're dealing with like public IP addresses and you have a limited number, but if you're dealing with these private non-routable address spaces, wouldn't it make more sense to... you wouldn't want to make like huge subnets of thousands of addresses, but wouldn't it make more sense to allocate 256 or 128 or something like that to make up for or to allow for future growth since you have a lot of IPs to play with?
It does to a point, and you have to be careful at what point that is, because a lot of people just take 10.1, 10.2, 10.3, 10.4 and just go, oh well, we'll just have a Class B for every office that has six machines. And that obviously is wasted IP address space. The point of the exercise was to teach you about networks and masks, not to make you subnet in the most efficient way possible. Makes mental note to write that in somewhere for the next lot of students. So yes, you probably could give them all 64 addresses each, and that would be a valid solution. But some would say that, obviously if they're private IP addresses, it doesn't matter as much. But if they were public IP addresses, you would have IP address wastage the subnets
I can see that
printers.
Yeah, that's my suggestion as well, Kerry. That edit will be helpful for future students. It's the aim of what you were after would answer my question of what I should spend time on.
No, I understand. See, the original exercise, which was written back in 2007, was meant to be a little bit cryptic, although not too cryptic. It was meant to be sort of a design specification that you would have to go away and work on and figure out how to actually implement, rather than having it all nicely spelt out in front of you and given all the masks and stuff. But I will clarify that in that exercise to make it clear that... Whilst IP address conservation is not strictly necessary for this scenario, the exercise is designed to make you consider the different size networks and masks.
Perfect. Thanks for that.
Ian?
Yeah, I think the only thing I did wrong on that on that Busy Builders one is as I'm looking back on it now, I don't think I put each office on a separate network. I think I did them all .1s, 192.168.1. I'll have to look back at it now.
Oh, that's bad. How would you be able to route from one office to the other if they're all on .1? Are you going to implement network address rewriting at the Linux IP level? It can be done, but I wouldn't recommend it.
No, I just, yeah, I was doing it in a hurry, and I mean, it's easy enough to change. I can go back and change.
Oh, good. Okay.
Well, I'm sorry about that. You can actually do it. Like, just from technical standpoint, what you can actually do is what's called an IP remap. And what you do is you tell the routers at the various offices to treat 1.blah as some other number. And you actually have it automatically doing a one-to-one NAT map of those IP addresses before they leave the gateway. And you can have all of the offices on 192.168.1. And as far as all the computers are concerned, they're all on .1.whatever. But you actually remap them out and mess around with DNSs and stuff, but I really wouldn't recommend that.
That's ugly.
But from a technical standpoint, it can be done. Okay, any other questions on subnet exercise 2? I will take the silence as acceptance that there is more tedious work to do, and that may happen by next may happen by next week. If you really, really need an extension, or you need some assistance, or you need some clarification, most of you have me on both of your Skypes. If you don't have my home Skype and you want it, get in touch with me via Exploration Instructors and I'll give it to you. I'm around a lot of the time, so I'm quite happy to help you guys out and talk it through with you guys. Yes, I did have some Canadian students call me at 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning to sort out some of the questions they had. And that was okay because they IM'd me first. So the key is to get people to understand, and I will make myself available to hopefully facilitate that that process. Otherwise, I'll set Grace onto you and we'll take it from there. Okie dokie. Now, that's enough subnetting. Well, it's kind of enough subnetting. Do we want a quick demonstration of BC? Would anybody interested in one of those if I fire up the cables and we get BC up and running and show you guys what it can do?
Yeah, sure.
All right. I know you got some of this on Friday, Corey, but we'll quickly whip through it again. Now, Kevin has given me a link to his library of functions. I don't know whether he wants the rest of you to have that or not, so that's up to him. If he does want the rest of you to have access to that, I can share that link with you all, but if he doesn't, I won't.
It's a bit cryptic, but sure, you can share it. It's just the source code, so if you load them all, then you'd still have to look in the source code to see what the function names are and how many arguments you need to call them, but I guess I'll say any of you can ask me questions if you're trying to play with something and having problems or something.
Okay, so there you go.
Problem is, these are all for Linux systems, so we have to figure out how they can convert it if they're on a Windows machine.
There are actually a couple of ways. If I were to stick them up on the website somewhere, the website would take care of the end-of-line conventions when it pulled them down. Or if we made them WinSCP-able somewhere. There are actually two utilities called FromDOS and ToDOS that will convert line endings, as will, I believe, Notepad++ and a few other things. And people are probably clever enough to work that out or harass us if they need them in a different CRLF format.
So essentially, the scripts, then you need to convert them into a Windows format for use, essentially?
Yeah, you need to convert the end of lines. Yeah. You need to convert the end of lines from LF to CRLF. Now, there are various ways of doing that. I used to use from DOS and to DOS. There is a utility called Flip. I don't know if anybody else has got any ideas as to how you do it, but they're the utilities I tended to use over the years.
Maybe I should make a set, one Linux-based and one DOS-based, and zip them up or something. Well, the Linux one's already zipped up, but...
Ah, look, I'm sure they're absolutely huge and gigantic, so what I'll do is I'll unzip the zip, make another folder inside that, and I can split them into two folders and call them Unix and Windows, and then just zip the whole zip up again, and then you'll have both, and nobody will have to convert anything. That's probably the easiest way to deal with it, I reckon. Okay, so I'm going to... shovel Jaws across in here. And let's hope this works.
Speaking of that, Curry, I need to get in touch with Tyler because I cannot make that damn script work for routing my sound card. I can do it, I just have to do it manually.
Ah, okay. Oh. That didn't work because I didn't have NUtils loaded. Okay, so, word to the wise people, launch NUtils. Okay, let's try it now. Basically, what the script does, and I'll certainly give you some contact information for Tyler, who will actually be happy to help you, believe it or not, is that it looks for what is in the combo boxes of the virtual audio repeater, and it selects what's in the combo boxes for virtual audio repeater, and then... hits the start button. That's basically all the script does.
Yeah, I mean, I've got it copied in exactly as it is from the combo box, and it's still not working.
I think the windows shouldn't be maximized, so they've got to be up at the default size, otherwise it changes what appears in the combo boxes. But I'm sure Tyler will be happy to help you out. There we go. And just to be infuriating, that just took me 3.5 seconds to launch three repeaters and three cables, so it's all good. Now, let's see which one I've got to inject Jaws into, because I can never remember. Three to Realtek output, so I inject Jaws into three. That's right. Okay. And I need to take two from the microphone. Okay, you guys are still hearing me? Looks like you are. So that's all good.
Yep.
And you should have Jaws here now too. It's a little bit choppy. I'm not sure why that is. It's a buffer underrun on this system. Okay. Let's show you some of the cool things that you can do with BC. I've got the Windows version.
Windows R, run dialog, CMD, enter, C4, backslash.
So, let's
CD,
see, backslash,
program, CD, backslash, program, files, enter, C4, backslash, program, files, reader, CD, GN, tab, CD, new, 32, enter, C4, backslash, program, files, backslash,
I assume everybody knew that there was tab completion under Windows. I didn't know that until recently. It's very cool.
Backslash, enter, bin, conrib, dot, info, man, manifest.
And we want to go into bin.
CD, bin, enter, C4, backslash, program, files, backslash, win32, backslash, reader.
Okay, and we run BC like this, BC.
BCE, reader.
You can make a shortcut to BC on your desktop. Hey, you could even have it in your startup. No, that's going a bit far. I actually knew people who had WinWord in their startup once. Okay, so this is what we call an arbitrary precision calculator.
Easy, enter, easy 1.06, copyright 1994, 1997, 1998, 2000 free software foundation, this is free software with absolutely no warranty, for the sales type warranty.
Okay, we're in. It's basically like a desk calculator. Now, at the moment, there's a couple of variables I'll talk to in a minute, but if I just put in 327 plus 1000 and... 85 and hit enter.
85, enter 1412.
It tells me that the answer is 1412. Okay. There is an odd thing though. If you go 1/3,
1/3, enter 0. 1/3.
It says 0. Now I'm going to explain why that happens in a second. Basically, there are a couple of variables. One of them is scale, and scale tells you how many decimal places you want to have. So I can say scale equals 7.
7, enter.
And go 1/3. So as you can see, 0.33333, etc. I can also say scale
equals
40.
Enter.
And I can go 1/7.
1/7. Enter. 0.14857.
It doesn't really care. How big the numbers are. I think there is arbitrary limits, but they're in the hundreds and thousands of digits. So obviously that makes things quite powerful. The other thing you can do in this is you've got plus, minus, times, divide, and you have percent, which is your moduli, so that'll give you the remainder of something. So say, for example, you're trying to convert 1,704 seconds into minutes, you can actually use the mod remainder to do that. Before I continue, does anybody have any questions on BC? Okay, so one of the other things you can do is you can say, you can actually set bases, and what you can say is go O base equals 2. Now my output base is set to binary. I can now put in 49,234. There you go. Convert it into binary just like that. If I put O base equals 16,
better.
And I put in 49,234, it's C052. Conversion just like that.
It's pretty slick.
The advantage of this thing, as Kevin has pointed out, is that it runs on the Mac, it runs on Windows, and it runs on Unix, and if you've got an SSH app for your iPhone, and you're not lucky enough to have Siri, and unlimited bandwidth, you can actually go in and you can actually go in and do those sorts of calculations. Now there is another nifty variable called last, and last is the last result you got. So if I go last, so I can go last times 2. I can also do x equals last. And then I can go x star 2, and as you can see, you can assign variables, so there's all sorts of programmy things you can do in here. If you have the math library loaded, which you can load with bc-l, you get a few trigonometric functions and a couple of other things that come in. And then Kevin's got some all sorts of nifty functions for Julian days and calculating pi and a few other things that are in that archive that I posted the link to on chat. But BC is an accessible, arbitrary precision calculator. It does have a read and a print in it, so you could theoretically do statistics. And it will allow you to very quick check your answers if, like me, you don't enjoy the binary stuff, the Windows calculator binary stuff. Any questions?
Yes, just barely related, and that's being generous. Which SSH iPhone client should we be using?
Prompt. You want prompt.
Cheers for that.
I'm just going to turn the cables off.
I'm trying to picture doing SSH on my iPhone and typing in command lines without going completely insane.
You got a Bluetooth keyboard.
Yeah, that is true. Could do it.
Bluetooth keyboard.
Which one are people using? I've got the Apple one, which is nice, but it doesn't really fold. I'd like some a little more compact.
I'm using the Freedom Input Universal. That one folds.
My understanding with the fold ones is the hinges make them less rugged. So, yeah, they're kind of nice when they fold up in your bag. But you've basically got two options. You can either get one that does fold up in your bag, and there are various ones that last for various amounts of time. Or you can actually get fast at typing on the screen, and may I recommend the Speed Dots Screen Protectors advertisement ends to help you get your touch type speed up on the screen.
Yeah, I've got that actually. Do you use the full keyboard or just the locator dots one?
Oh, I don't have one because I'm good at typing on the screen. I'm one of these blind people with fairly good fine motors, and you know, I pulled things apart when I was a kid. So once you learn roughly where the letters are, it's just a case of swipe and drop. the trick to learning to type on the iDevices is learning where the letters are going to show up, and that's what the screen protectors help with. But I find the screen of the iPod so small that it's easy enough for me to learn the proximity without the screen protector. I really shouldn't say that because I actually we actually sell them over here in Australia, but I personally don't use them.
Yeah, I've got one, and I'm still trying to decide if it's what I like or if I would rather just do without it. I'm not totally sure yet.
Yeah, you're probably right. Prompt doesn't do Telnet. We'll work on some sort of redirecty thing to fudge that in somehow at some point, because that would be nice to be able to SSH in and get to stuff with Prompt on the bundle.
My thought exactly.
Now, will VoiceOver automatically read stuff, or do you actually have to swipe and stuff to get the...
It reads it. No, it reads.
Oh, that's cool.
It's not perfect, but none of Apple's terminal reading is ever perfect, but Prompt have made an effort to do as much with VoiceOver as they can to make it as accessible as possible. I don't know whether Kevin's been in touch with the developers, but I certainly know... Christopher Toff has, and has spoken to them about the importance of VoiceOver accessibility, and they have listened and worked on that.
Neat, I'll go grab that.
Yeah, it's a couple of dollars, so, you know, be warned that it is not a free app, but I think it was $1.99 or something. It was really, really cheap. It wasn't much.
$8.
Is it really that much? $8?
Yeah.
Okay. Alright, so just be a bit careful, but it is really, really good. Like, put it this way, I don't remember spending the $8 on it, and it rocks.
It only does SSH.
Sorry?
It only does SSH, right?
Yes, it only does SSH.
But that's okay, you could SSH into your Linux thing, and then you could turn it from there, or run Tintin or a mud client, and you could probably actually do some mudding through.
Yeah, that'd be how I'd do it.
Sorry, Kerry, I believe I've pulled you completely off track.
Oh, no, you Apple people have got to have your little fix, or, you know, yeah. Every time we don't advance the Apple bandwagon, an Apple acolyte perishes in some horrible non-Apple-related disaster. So there's our little Apple thing for the day. I've got to give Jobs one thing. He's good at marketing.
Oh, but we've tied it to Linux. What do you want?
What you need now is a sounding board, and you need that typical sound of somebody burning in the fire. You know, just.
Yeah, well, we'll pass on that. But look, unfortunately, and we're not going to get into a discussion on this, most of the other accessible options were taken out of our hands, so we're left with Apple. What can I say? There are a couple of droiders, but Apple is what most people are running live with, so we, you know, carry the torch and do the Apple thing. I think... Did we want to break early today and have a full week next week on the routers so that I can have all of the workstation pods up and running? You can certainly play with them between now and next week. Or do we want to do some stuff on the routers anyway? We can do a little bit on the routers. My Dropbox file is on Dropbox, but because I'm upgrading this machine to Windows 7 today, I've disassociated the Dropbox, so I can't update it.
I'd be happy breaking early and doing a whole bunch of stuff next week if we could do, you know, devote a lot of time to that.
Well, I don't really want to talk too much more about subnetting unless people really need it. Because, you know, I mean, if you need it, I'll do it. But it's like, yeah, subnetting, I think, pretty bored of subnetting, but it is important. So I'd be happy to do lots of stuff on the routers next week and really hook into the RIP and all that sort of stuff next week, depending on how people feel about that.
Yeah, because we have, what, a half an hour left or so?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I vote for next week on it, because I think it'll probably take longer than a half an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
For our other stuff, Carrie, should we, I haven't looked ahead, so forgive me for asking, should we still be at around Chapter 6 and the Cisco stuff for labs and texts? I have no idea what 7 is, I haven't looked.
Yeah, that's good enough for the moment. I'm really trying to get the subnetting stuff shaken down, and we'll do the 7-8 stuff towards the end. There are some labs in chapter 11 that involve you setting messages of the day and stuff on the routers. We have actually lectured the stuff up to chapter 8 if you want to take the exams. But I want to give people a break from the written labs and do a bit of practical stuff, and then you guys can tack off the rest of the rest of the written labs at the end.
Okay, works for me.